I only found out about this Zoom yesterday late afternoon. I had to take my mother to a doctor yesterday, and I only found out about it the evening of the night before. So that's 2 days in a row, unexpected things, kind of like, you know, thrown on me. So Kamalamala asked, well, we could cancel it because, you know, you weren't expect. I said, no. You announced it. I have to do that. It is my responsibility, my duty. I am obligated. So all morning I'm walking around going, I don't wanna. I'm a grump. So what do I do when I don't wanna? Because I thought, you know, you folks, you come here with all good faith and good intentions, and I'm just going to be rotten and miserable, and everybody's going to hate every minute. So then, what do when I don't want to? I go to my deities, I go to my temple room, and I say, I don't want to. And they say, that's interesting. Sit down. Uh-huh. Why is that interesting? And they said, well, you know, everybody feels like that nowadays. So you're just like everybody. None of us want to do anything nowadays. The whole world is so screwed up. So that's your subject. I was trying to remember, I think I might have given a lecture long ago, you know, on the other server, that my server. I think it was called, What Do You Do When You Can't? And as far as I remember, that turned out pretty good. So today, what do you do when you don't wanna? Now, you can do it and feel very resentful. I don't wanna do this. This is ruining me. This is creating a mess. Grumble, grumble, grouch, grouch. If you notice, that's what kids do when you force them to do something they don't want to do. It's like, rawr, 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 rawr. And then the deities, because they're so good at this stuff, they said, well, who else was in a situation where they didn't want to? And I thought, wow, Arjuna, he was there on that old battlefield and he said, I don't want to. And he said, grouch, grouch, grumble, grumble. I said, wow, now I feel better. If Arjuna didn't want to, and he was grumbling and grouching, gee, that's interesting.
Interesting.
And not only that, but that was the whole point of the Bhagavad Gita. So that included all kinds of things. But is that relevant to me? Because I'm the original groucher in this discussion. There's no battlefield. There's no, like, you know, universal arrangement that has to be made. There's no massive historical significance here. And all of that is true. But interestingly, it's not that I don't want to anymore. Now, I want to. But now we have another problem. I don't really have anything to say. My entire lecture was just given in that last one page of text. Huh. Life is interesting. Even when you're in a situation where it's not working, things don't make sense. There's like this disturbance. There's like these distractions, obstacles. Here you are in the moment. The moment does not really include desire. Desire is more something we think of and we feel that's related to a future. And when we say, I don't want to, that is very much related to a future. Now, if you live in the moment, the idea of desire is seen very differently. I want this. But that presumes many things. The first is that this I want is attainable. The second is I will live long enough for that process to get it, and that thing will exist long enough in that process to get it. Like, for example, I desire this parking spot, but as I'm driving to it, somebody else comes and takes it. So there are many factors which enter into this idea of desire. And not wanting something is not actually qualitatively different. It's procedurally different. To not want something means to push it away or not endeavor for it. To want something means to endeavor to get it and expect that all the conditions favorable for that remain. If we think about being, being is divorced from these two states. Yes. Let's go back to Arjuna just for a second. Here he is not wanting. Did he have the option to simply be? Well, yes. He could have just sat there in a lotus position on his chariot. And as soon as the battle started, he would have had an arrow through his head. Now, is that an option? Yes. Is it an acceptable option? No. This brings up a whole nother issue. Are we able to live in the moment when we're dealing with a desire to do or not do? When you are dealing with a desire to do or not do, you are no longer able to remain in the moment. If you want to remain in the moment, you have to have no desire to do or not do. No desire to accept something or reject something. That's what I mean when I say not do. So this raises a very deep philosophical question. What is the use of the concept of now? What is the use of the concept of living in the moment? In some respects, that's mind-boggling. In another sense, it's the definition of being versus doing. It's something we can hold in our minds very easily. There's being, where you simply are in the moment, and there's doing, where you're active. Then we're back to another thing. For example, where Krishna says that even in inaction, there's action. Let's say Arjuna is sitting on the chariot in this state of being and the battle starts. He thinks it's inaction. Somebody else shoots an arrow in his head. It's action. Because he's making the statement, I shall not defend myself. He may not have thought he was making that statement, but he is making the statement by being in that situation and doing nothing. Conclusion, you can't avoid action. This world is filled with action. Then how does it work? There's being. How does being fit in? Yet we know being fits in. We feel it. It's not difficult. We enter into the state of meditation and we feel being. We feel our spiritual energy. Okay, so we can experience being. We feel it. We know it exists. We know that state exists and we can attain it. Yet at the same time, this kind of polemic, this constant push and pull that doing places upon being also exists. So this raises a question. Can being and doing coexist simultaneously? Let's make one more step. Where does this happen? Does it happen in the same dimension? Or is this an interdimensional thing? Let's just propose a theory You're in this state of being, and it is that divine connection, that feeling of boundlessness, this absorption in spirit. That dimension is quite large. Indeed, it's limitless, but we can't think of limitless, so we just say it's quite large. And within that, there's this smaller dimension of doing. So if you're thinking of being is over here and doing is over there, then it becomes a big problem to stick these together and make them work. But if being is this big, practically limitless domain, and doing is this much smaller one within it, then doing rests within being. All problems solved. How often do we think like that? You know, I very much objected to the idea that, you know, there's this spiritual being that we don't have connection to, and then there's this material being that we got to purify and kind of dissolve and get rid of until we can get to that spiritual being. But this idea of the spiritual dimension, and within that we're hosting this doing dimension within it, the subspace, allows us to have a graphic depiction of a reality within which we live. Think about Arjuna. When we think about Arjuna's situation and how he acted after the Gita was finished, this imagery allows us to understand much better. It also allows us to understand spiritual personalities who walk amongst us. It also allows us to understand, for example, really advanced mystic powers. Because if your consciousness is within that dimensional of being, you can look into the dimension of doing with a totally different vision. It's like when children are having a tea party, and they're at their table having their tea party, and the mother is looking from beyond. She can manipulate that tea party as she likes for the pleasure of the children or to interrupt them. Similarly, those who have that location awareness of their consciousness to locate themselves within the arena of being, I know that's contradictory, but stick with me, have the capacity to manipulate this arena of doing with great skill. Let's say you're in a kirtan with Lord Chaitanya in a very intimate setting in Navadvipa. The qualification to be in that place is that your consciousness is within this dimensional space of being. And you have this floor, you have these drums and kartals, you have a body which can dance, a voice that can sing. All of that exists within the dimension of doing. But when the evolved divine personalities use these things, the quality of them change. Not that the floor becomes spiritual, not that the clay of the Murdunga becomes spiritual directly. I don't mean like that. There are vibrations created. The way the Murdunga is hit, the way the melody is vibrated, this is under the control of the consciousness. So the consciousness of being is creating a vibration that is compatible with the being. The elements themselves are within the dimension of doing, but the manipulation of these elements are according to the dimension of being. We've often heard that when you use something in the service of Krishna, it becomes spiritual. But that is a very one-dimensional sentence. You can tell somebody playing Murdunga When you use this mridanga to chant Hare Krishna, it becomes spiritual. But does it? Just because you say that this happens doesn't mean that it does. The idea is not to simply use something in the service of Krishna. That's okay, that's correct, but that's not the point. The point is to be in that state of being where you are connected with that divine energy and then express something within the dimension of doing. And because all those frequencies in that kirtan of Lord Chaitanya's were so connected, were so beautifully manifesting within the realm of that spiritual energy, it would be absolutely transcendent to bring you, to throw you into the highest states of spiritual ecstasy. Therefore, the quality of what one does when it is within the context of knowing what you're doing is so important. I know this might sound, when I say it, it might sound obvious, but the implications of this are enormous. Can you imagine if you enter into a sacred space and everybody places themselves within, everybody places themselves in divine energy and then does something, because even every fits, it resonates, it echoes, it reverberates with the heart, with the spirit, with the higher energies, the higher beings. It creates an entire resonance. And then when others who are also within that resonance respond, it stays in that resonance and amplifies with each response that is taking place in that atmosphere. That's a package deal. It's homogeneous. And in Lord Chaitanya's kirtan, if even one person was not within that resonance, it would disrupt the entire thing. In the Chaitanya Charitam, you hear Lord Chaitanya saying, the ecstasy is not coming. Who is here? When 100% of the intention and action within that spiritual arena is the divine, it works. It just brings everyone there. This is called alchemy. Alchemy is very difficult. Alchemy is the process by which you take various ingredients that normally don't fit together, stick them all together, and make something else entirely, usually gold or something. Alchemy requires perfection. It requires every single last detail to be perfect for the reaction to take place. In this way, being and doing join to become one thing. And that becomes a mystic reality that is indescribable. I think that the appreciation of this mystic culture we have been introduced into is essential, but it must be understood actually according to what it really is. I mean, just doing things and expecting a result, it doesn't work. Bhakti is not just love and devotion, and it's not just some service. Bhakti is the art of being, that being in the atmosphere of being and doing. It is the act of being in this consciousness the consciousness, that state of being, which is just pure spiritual, and performing an act of love for the deities, for Radha Krishna, for in spiritual love, just performing that act. So the idea of a desire being the essential point in any action is not as important as one might have thought. Once one is absorbed in the state of being, expressions of that state of being create all kinds of actions. This is the key to the way in which the entire spiritual world works. Okay, I'm going to take a break. You can think about that. So are there any thoughts?
Are there any questions?
Well, thoughts, questions, whatever you like. It's your time.
I want to ask the question. When you are saying about being, this state of being means that we will be conscious about us, about God's and Supreme, or maybe somebody only feel himself and nobody else.
Okay, so that, when I said no, I guess I was being unfair. Yes, the state of being is in its perfection. It includes the energy of the divine in this usness of connection. Yes. And at the same time, to attain that state of being, one of the requirements is full conscious awareness and acceptance of self. But because self is a conscious subset of the divine, one flows to the other.
Thank you. But it is difficult to be conscious about oneself. It is even that is difficult, really be conscious.
Yep. Yeah, that's actually a great question, and I was trying to avoid having to talk about it. And the reason is because it's mind-boggling. I don't even know if I can deal with it. But you asked, I will try. Let's say it's not like it's a theory, but we have an experience of feeling in this state of pure being. We have this experience. And were we to express that feeling, what would that look like? Let's say we were playing the mridanga and another person was playing the kartals, and we were in that state. We're in, what is it, Shivananda Sain's house, I forgot exactly. And we're ready to get into that kirtan. So we start the kartals are going, and the rhythm starts, the meter starts. So what is starting is not a product of our desire. It's a product of the feeling we are in. Desire was not actually part of that feeling. But when we feel the connection, we have a desire to amplify it, to do it more. The expression, the creativity, the expansion of that feeling inspires more. So far, we have no problem with this. But I would like to propose that the problem is with the word. When you say, you means us, when we say desire, it brings all kinds of ideas with it. But do any of those ideas fit within that, No. But do we feel something that we could label as a desire when we're doing it and we want, desire to increase. Well, yeah, we could, you know, run into trouble with this idea of desire to do, and the desire that arises from doing, and it just wants to get more. The problem is how we define it. So if we were giving a lecture, and you know, then we could get around all of this very complex state of being, feeling, by saying there's over here those material desires, and over here the spiritual desires. Now these terms, yes, they're true, they're real, but do they actually tell us anything? If we end up in a place of, oh my God, I'm filled with material desire, how will I ever get tame spiritual desire? That's not the point. Therefore, I didn't want to use the word desire. The word desire, whether or not you stick material or spiritual in front of that word, it carries baggage. Carrying that word around is like dragging a bunch of rocks. It really makes it tough to talk. Every time you use desire, you have to start modifying it. You have to start making conditions on it. You have to start making comparisons. Very troublesome. And because we have all been incredibly conditioned by struggling with that word, which speaks about some kind of feeling, I wanted to avoid it. So what I did was I tried to stick within the functional expansion of what happens from whatever state you were in. You know, you're going to go to translator heaven, I'm telling you, because I'm saying things in a way which I don't even know how you understand it. I'm telling you, it's like you're going to go to translator heaven.
But perhaps you have some telepathic skills, because most often I just see image.
Okay, that's good. Now, the thing is, let's use an example here. I think it'll become clear. You enter into a room and there's food preparations all over, and the aroma is driving you wild and your mouth starts watering. You've entered into this state and you're just completely absorbed in going and grabbing and eating and stuffing. What's important here is not desire. Desire is something involved, but that's not the most essential thing. The most important part of this is that atmosphere, which creates this energetic reciprocation between you and what you are and this stuff over here. And then there becomes this reciprocation, these exchanges. Did you catch that? Now, let's put it to being. You're dancing and you're there in the rasa dance. Krishna's there. The gopis are there. The music is there. The rhythm is there. The meter is there. The mood is there. The atmosphere is there, and the moon and the everything is there. And it's just so, you're just floating and absorbing and just feeling it. There is no desire to stop it. You don't need desire to continue it, because you're in it. If you can catch that, that's why I did it between these two kinds of things. If you can catch that, you understand perfectly the role of desire within being. It's not a simple thing. It's not an obvious thing. It's something that you float into. And when that happens, you wouldn't even be thinking about it. It just is. So how could you talk about it? But I did, imperfectly. Good luck, that's what I said. Okay, next question. Events in the spiritual world are eternal, not occurring in time. That is a resolution of doing and being. Can we really understand that kind of thing? No, you can't understand it. That was the whole point of what I just said. You can't understand it. By its very nature, it's not understandable. You can't analyze it. You cannot write down the steps by which it happened. Because if there were steps, it didn't happen. There are no steps to attaining being. You just feel. You accept, you absorb, you are. There are no steps. You can't talk about it. I mean, how could you? It's not something related to anything mental where language ultimately sits. Has nothing to do with intellect, has nothing to do with intelligence, because feeling is related entirely to being. That consciousness is of being. And all this analysis and stuff is very much absorbed within acts, events, doing, studies, and figuring out and determining steps and formulas and ideas and concepts. A philosophy is as rational and with steps and with reason and logic as math is. It is something you... So the idea of that we can understand, the word understand is key here. Can you understand it? I don't think so. Can you feel it? Absolutely. Does that help?
Sometimes when we are doing something, it becomes to the state of being itself. Possible?
You know, Zen Buddhism, in those parts are like the arrow or the flower arranging and stuff like that. It uses the idea of so concentrating on the event that the event itself disappears and the state remains. And I think that there are many examples of people who attain very advanced states by such focused concentration and disconnecting themselves from any external things. And the reason that works is because when you have taken everything away except your consciousness, consciousness is so powerful that it creates connections far beyond these things of this world.
Can we say that when we meditate on deities or on Krishna, I mean, not deities, just an image in our mind, by our consciousness, because of power of our consciousness, we are already in contact with him. Or
say that again.
I mean, when we meditate or we just look at the deities without any other ideas, then because of the power of our consciousness, we are already in real contact with him.
Yes, yes, yes. Not the power of our consciousness alone, the power of our consciousness in connection with them.
And one more question. Can we say that Lord Krishna, the Supreme, he loves all his parts, all the beings, really loves, or it is something else? This question is maybe sound not good, but anyway, it is a question.
Well, that brings up a whole pile of issues. Let's do the most obvious answer and skip all those issues. Let's imagine you have this beautiful model and she's looking in the mirror and says, "Oh, I hate my nose." I mean, they do that. They have various forms of self-hatred of various parts of their body because it's not like what they think should be perfect. So what would we think about that person? Might say, what are you, crazy? You're already beautiful. Isn't that enough? So just imagine you're God and you hate some part of you. You would also say there's something wrong with that. But let's say your finger hurts. Let's say your finger has been damaged, or there's some trauma, or it's cold. You would want to somehow or another help it to change that state. So in that way, God wishes to that each of the parts are coming to the proper compatible state. Now, that is an answer you would hear, I suppose, in any kind of like Hindu temple of any sort, even any ISKCON temple. That's the standard kind of response. But what actually is going on in regard to every single living, you're talking about the infinite, and the infinite's exchange and experience of the infinitesimal, the infinite number of infinitesimals. How can we possibly talk about it? So I can guarantee you, we have no idea. But you can give the answer I gave, and it would maybe be correct. You asked the question and then you answered the question. Very good. Because that's the answer. Like, for example, I just read an article that they're doing these space vehicles that are taking pictures of Mercury right now. So can you meditate yourself to be sitting on Mercury? No, because you have zero experience of it. Even if you were to see a picture, you still have zero experience because it's like 450 degrees Celsius in the sun and minus 180 degrees Celsius in the cold side. And when we ask you to connect to the divine, do we demand you have experience of that? But we ask you to have connection to yourself. And self is a known commodity. And because self is a subset of divine, the connection is easy. So yes, your answer is very good.
Then we often listening for many people that God wants that we serve him. But somebody asked me, but what does he need? He have everything. So except the serving in the temples to the deities there, how can one serve God?
Well, you have the same problem as you had with the word desire. You're dragging a huge bag of rocks with that word. Serve. It has so many things attached to it. Servants serve the master. Servants bring things to the master, feed the master, dress the master, clean for the master. The servants do everything. We read it in the books, like serving the czar. We read it and we see it on TV and we see it in the movies. But does that concept translate to Radha and Krishna? So when you use the word serve, you're already carrying rocks and rocks and rocks. It's very hard. So get rid of the word serve. And think in terms of the concept of energetic exchange, energetic gifts or offering. Even offering has its problem. Gifts to give. What's good about that? No expectation of return, just to give because of love. But then there's practical considerations that actually transcend this difficulty of how bhakti manifests. Then we get into another word, seva. You invite Radha and Krishna into the temple, yet you don't clean it. You don't, of course you clean it. You clean the temple, you organize the temple, you get the lights, you get the sounds, you get the air conditioning, you get the people and their flow, you get the ceremonies. This is all part of it. You become part of the package. You're part of this important arrangement of the deities. You're not a servant. You're a partner. And together, you are expressing this divine love. Now, maybe there are big partners in this partnership and little partners, but they're partners. And that is very important to understand when we talk about these kind of things, because, you know, these words screw up our heads when we hear them. You know, if you go in front of the deities and you're Quasimodo, you know, coming to serve the deity, Quasimodo here, ready to serve deity. Or you come to the deities and you're a partner in that loving exchange, it's totally different. So who of these two do you think Radha and Krishna would rather have taking care of them? Well, look at Radha and Krishna's pastimes. Look at how they, everybody is together within them. They love this teamwork, this group, the group of this, these partners all working together to create this mood, this energy, this atmosphere. That is bhakti.
If you could please kindly tell us how to be constantly always in present moment without thinking about future or past.
That's not possible. That's fiction. You cannot live like that. Let's imagine you're a person with instantaneous amnesia who doesn't remember what just happened. You take a step into a room, but you forgot why you did that. You reach for something, but forget why. The past is integrally related to the present. In this world, you cannot avoid the past because it is the way in which every moment is built. And if you don't have connection to the future, well, when you take that next step, where are you going? Why are you going there? This world we live in is arranged so that past and future are integral aspects of existence. So you can't avoid that. That's why I gave the example of the exterior being dimension, which is very large. And then within it is this small environment of doing, which has all this past, present, and future and junk. Okay, everybody, I stop there. I thank you very much. It's been a great pleasure today. Even though I wanted to. Goodbye for now. See you again.